Music Session number 10729, Reel 2.
Crew Captain Cunningham, Reel 2.
You could still see that same distance ahead, but from a much lower altitude, such as flying low over the sea, you could direct your radar beam slightly above the level and still retain the range, whereas the early radar was incapable of use at low level over the sea because its maximum range was considerably less than your height over the sea, so it was totally useless. And the introduction of the centimeter radar made it possible to, vastly increase the capabilities. And all this, one had to learn how to make best use of it.
Did you personally have to go to Malvern to coordinate with the Boffins?
Oh, I used to go keep closely in touch, both at Swanage, which was in 1940, and perhaps the very earliest part of 41, but then when the whole establishment was centred on or moved to Malvern, I also used to continue keeping closely in touch.
Who did yes. you used to see?
Oh, the various of the brains. I suppose... there's a fine lot of names of people that were involved, whom I used to meet. It's difficult for me to pick out any one name, except that, of course, the then administrator of the varied people involved was Rowe. He was the Dr. Rowe, I think, was called the administrator, and he played a great part in the organising of the teams in what was then called TRE, I think, Telecommunications Research Establishment.
Jimmy Rawnsley's book, which we were discussing some time ago, gives an account of this
yes.
period. How accurate, how good an account do you think it is?
I think it's a very good account, because it's a very straightforward and genuine one. It's as seen by us in the squadron at the time. And I look on it as, yes, entirely in keeping with what I recall.
You were talking about approaching the enemy bomber to shoot it down. In how much danger were you from their gunfire?
Well, we were always wide open to the gunners underneath, or the tail gunner, because in the fighter, having got radar contact and closed in and positioned ourselves so that hopefully we were not coming in if we were over the sea, and there's a moon down the illuminated path, that anyone looking backwards from the bomber at the sea would spot silhouetted against this bright light moon path on the sea, the fighter that's coming in. So we had to be sure what our background was and whether to come into the side, but always beneath, because we wanted to, our view was only upwards. And then we had to identify the aircraft, because as often as not, it was one of our own that we would come in beneath, whether it was a bomber or another fighter. So, and we could only identify the aircraft by its wing plan form, which you could only see if you got underneath it. So, knowing full well that the average person in an aeroplane finds it more difficult to look down than he does to look up, we were safer underneath. We would come right in underneath and decide, and to double check, I always when I could see this thing clearly above me, told Jimmy Rawns there to forget his radar at the moment I'd got it well in view, to take a look. I wouldn't tell him what I thought it was. I'd say, "What's that? What do you think that is?" He'd say, "Well, it's a Heinkel 111 or whatever it was." And only it confirmed it to me, because it was nice to, well, have that assurance. And then from that moment on, we had to then come up, because we might be nearly, 800 feet, 500 feet, 800 feet beneath this aircraft. And whilst keeping close to it, within sight, slowly come up, and we were vulnerable then, and of course we were fired at and hit on one or two occasions by rather more alert gunners who were there to do that job. But as often as not, we were able to get right up to the just below the level of the aircraft in front, and aiming to keep our nose up, which meant that we would have to be falling back, so flying slightly slower to still remain beneath it, fire into a, not a knife edge view, but a semi, well, slightly from below, you'd get a better target to aim at. And then, of course, if you hit it and didn't pull out of the way very quickly, as often as not, the bits would fall off, you would get damaged or hit by quite a number of bits of the aircraft. And so, as often as not, when you had four cannon into a target, it was a few rounds and then there was a big flash and you stopped firing and pulled away.
Were you ever shot down yourself by an enemy bomber?
No, I was shot at and hit, but I always managed to get back to land. Maybe I lost an engine or I had a windscreen and smashed and I had a bullet come through just through the top of the helmet and through the screen. That was in a Mosquito, but yes, I had a Bow Fighter and Mosquito. Some of one two gunners were pretty alert.
During the Battle of Britain winter of 40-41, how many successes do you think that you had?
Well, our successes at night didn't happen until after the, really after the Battle of Britain, which is the day battle.
Sorry, I mean the Blitz of 40-41.
Oh, 40-41. Oh, well, I can't. I have a record of the combats and when they took place in my own logbook. What I do know is that by the time my first Bow Fighter was shot down, strangely, not with me flying it then, that particular aeroplane, I think I had had 12 successful combats, and it was shot down in May 1941. When being flown by another pilot in my squadron who had a successful combat but at the same time was shot down and his aircraft caught fire, my aircraft rather that he was flying, caught fire and he had to abandon it and it fell into the ground somewhere behind Bournemouth.
What did you and the other pilots in your squadron feel about the German air crews that were coming over to blitz the British cities in 40-41? Did you hate them?
No, I think all I felt was that they were so safe, well, feeling so safe, and they had very good grounds to feel that way, that they were seldom, if ever, intercepted, certainly the main mass of the raids, that I wasn't surprised that sometimes the gunners didn't fire back or didn't fire at us, because I remember one or two of us thinking, well, perhaps they're so confident they're not even looking out, they may even be playing cards or something, but not concerned, because night fighters, as far as they were concerned, were very ineffective or totally ineffective in England. But that picture changed, of course, very quickly. I looked on them doing a job that they were having to do. It was a distasteful one, and anything I could do to stop that was what I was there for.
You mentioned the famous Coventry raid in the autumn of 1940. Did you personally go up to try to intercept that?
Oh, yes, I remember seeing the enormous glow in the sky. We were flying from Middle Wallop, and generally Middle Wallop southwards out to the Channel, and one could see this glow in the Midlands. I didn't know exactly what part of the Midlands, but so that was a very long distance away. And before taking off on one of those nights on the ground at Middle Wallop, I was able not only to hear but to see on some occasions a few trails. They weren't very high, these German aircraft then. They were 10 or 15,000 feet was the sort of average height they were coming in at. But in November, on occasions, propeller aeroplanes would sometimes leave trails. And being on the ground, looking up and seeing these, then of course going off into the bow fighter, you neither hear anything, or well, nor do you see when you're flying at that height these trails, and feeling rather not totally impotent, but thinking, oh God, if any of this radar will work. And eventually we had radar that worked and were able to use it and make it do its real job.
When talking about night fighting, people always talk about this business of night vision. Can you tell me what your own opinions are about that?
Oh, I was firmly of the opinion from a very long time that night vision was probably the last part of the long chain of events that have got to be achieved before you can complete the combat. The real problem was, could the pilot, together with his radar operator, the radar operator firstly interpret the picture that he got on his radar set, the pilot fly the aircraft to whatever instructions he had from the radar operator as to where the target was, and between the two of them to control the aircraft into a point at which you could reasonably expect to see a target. But that was only where night vision, the very final step, came in. But if the chap's night vision wasn't very good, he could go in closer within the capability of the radar, which would be minimum range would be perhaps 800 feet. Well, anyone with reasonable eyesight could see, particularly if you were in the correct position beneath the aircraft, where you were likely to see the exhaust flames, could see the target. So night vision was really the last thing in the long chain, which was perhaps the ground, first of all, a ground radar control station that could put the fighter within a reasonable distance and direction, similar direction to the target, for the aircrew to then drive their night fighter in to that. There was a huge organization on the ground in the radar control stations that would firstly put the night fighter into the position where the crew ought to be able to get a radar contact on the incoming target, and then the aircrew had got to drive their aircraft using the information from their own radar into the closer range at which the pilot with normal vision should be able to see the exhaust flames of the target. And only from that point on did the pilot's night vision become any factor at all. But if the pilot's night vision wasn't particularly good, he had only got to go in to the minimum range that the radar would allow, which was between 800 and 900 feet, and almost anyone could see exhaust flames then. So the night vision was highly overrated in the actual success of an interception and shooting down of an aircraft by night. It's not to say that night vision wasn't extremely useful, and the limitations of your own vision by night ought to be known by, and were known by, most pilots. But pure night vision did not play very much part in successful night interception.
You mean each pilot's night vision was actually measured in meters or something?
There were some tests which the medical experts at the RAF devised for dim light recognition of various objects. And, of course, those of us that were in a night fighter squadron before the war were never involved in any of these tests. And eventually, in about late 1941, the Air Vice Marshal Livingston, who was in charge of night vision research, insisted that I carry out night vision tests, because I had been saying all along that night vision was highly overrated. It was ability to fly by night, fly an aircraft successfully, and for a radar operator to use his radar set successfully, and a combination of the two that made a successful night fighter crew. Eventually, when I did take the standard RAF night vision tests, my results were just barely average. And Livingston, I can remember saying, "Cunningham, you didn't try. You're not trying." And I said, "No, I've just done what the best I can do." And he never believed that I wasn't seriously doing what the best I could. And I think it proved the point which I knew perfectly well, that night vision played a small part in the success or otherwise of an interception by night.
Because you've got this nickname of Cat's Eye, haven't you?
Yeah, but that was given by the Air Ministry to cover up the fact that we were a night fighter, we were flying aircraft that had got radar in 1940 and early 1941, because for security reasons there was never any mention of radar in fighters in that period. And as I had two or three successes, the Air Ministry felt they would have to explain that I had very good vision by night. I actually had very good vision by day and average by night, but I was told, well, you've got to put up with that.
So it was a deception ploy?
Yes, for security reasons.
All this business of eating carrots, that was just a silly propaganda thing, was it?
Well, it was done at the same time that night vision was affected, improved, well, not improved, but put at its best that the human could produce when having vitamin A or vitamin C, one of the vitamins, which before the war used to, in many cases, come from oranges, but there were no oranges imported in that 1940 period. But carrots could produce the same vitamin and were grown naturally, and the Ministry of Food wanted to encourage children, anyone, everyone, to make use of carrots. And so that was the origin of that story.
Do you remember the Blitz coming to a sudden end when the Germans turned their
attention
to the Russians?
Oh, yes, in June 41. Oh, what a relief. I remember all of us in the squadron thinking, well, how extraordinary. Well, thinking, what a foolish move on the German part to turn east. But I think all of us thought, good God, fancy Germany turning east. And it took a great deal of pressure off the defences of this country.
Before we leave the Blitz, I don't think really we've said sufficient about the ground control people. Can we say more about that?
Yes, the ground control radar, ground control of fighters, night fighters, really got going at the end of 1940 and the early part of 1941. And each sector had its own ground control station, which was somewhere near the south coast. In the case of our sector, between the Isle of Wight and Lion Bay, our ground control was a place called Sopley, which was just behind Christchurch. And it first of all started off simply a small caravan with a radar aerial on top that was turned round by a chain driven system, very crude and very simple. And we had a marvellous controller who interpreted the picture and could see what was coming from nearly as far out as the Channel Islands, approximately there. And we and our fighters would be going up and down the channel on a patrol line. He could only control really two fighters at a time, was about the maximum, maybe sometimes three fighters. He would see something coming in that looked likely coming out of northern France into England, and would then direct whichever fighter was most conveniently placed on to intercept that, to lead it in to a point about 2 miles behind the incoming aircraft and turn it on to the track of the incoming aircraft. And it was then up to the radar operator to, in your own aircraft, hopefully being aware of the instructions that the range between you and the target, and it was crossing you right to left, and then it was approximately the same height, or they were not accurate in giving height, but could give plan position and some idea that you were the similar height to the target. And then a lot of the rest then remained with the crew that were turned in, hopefully within radar range, as to then taking on the interception. And the moment the crew were happy, they would say to the ground, okay, we have contact. And having said that, they would usually switch off the radio to the ground, because it was so important for the pilot and the operator to not have anyone else talking or get any blockage of the speech between the radar operator and the pilot. And until you'd actually had combat or got it right close in.
Can you briefly sketch the kind of work that you were doing between the end of the Blitz and the first appearance of the Mosquitoes?
Oh, we had occasional night fighter raids right through 41, from the time when Germany turned east into Russia, up until, yes, there was always some activity at night. There was mine laying. Quite a lot of mine laying took place in and off the Bristol Channel, and various odd raids would take place, so the night fighters were kept on their toes the whole time. I remained active at Middle Wallop till the end of July 1942, when I was then posted away for 6 months to be the wing commander training of the night fighter group that was responsible for the training of night fighter pilots and operators before going to the squadrons in the what were called night operational training units.
Then I think in January 43 you took up your post at Hunsdon with 85
yes.
Squadron.
Yes. And that was one of the tasks that I had when I was the wing commander training of this night fighter OTU group, was to assure, to get a reliable supply of pilots from the night fighter squadrons who had success at night to go on their rest and operations as instructors to the night OTUs. There was a great reluctance to go to them because, it being a non-operational job, it didn't have the satisfaction of bringing any combats to a successful conclusion. I wanted successful night fighter pilots to be instructors for a limited time, and I was able to get Fighter Command to agree, which had not been agreed before, that there would be a limited time of posting as an instructor to an OTU of 6 months. And given I wanted to be able to give pilots from squadrons the assurance that they could then go back to a squadron on operations after 6 months, I made that one of the hopeful conditions applying to me as well. And in fact, I was fortunate, and the OTUs did stand by their guarantees to pilots that they would go for 6 months as an instructor before going back to operations on the same or perhaps another night fighter squadron. So I went to the Mosquitoes. It was fortunate to be posted to command 85 squadron on Mosquitoes in January 1943.